This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the virtual space where a big current topic gets together with you, me and the top experts for 28 minutes. This week, the new political geography of Britain. Who are we now and how has that changed? Something big is changing in British politics, and that something is us. Recent by-elections all seem to point in different directions, telling us different stories about who we are politically. So what is going on with us? What can we say about the new political demography of Britain? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's go back three decades to 1991. The Conservatives are in their third consecutive term. There is no Scottish Parliament or Welsh Assembly. It has only been 25 years since England has won a major football tournament. So who were we then? Here's the Briefing Room's John Murphy.
This clearly isn't about me, but maybe you remember this.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts.
Right Said Fred released this in July 1991. It topped the charts in seven countries, but only reached second spot here in the UK. Naturally, there were more serious things happening too. John Major had taken over as Prime Minister from Margaret Thatcher the previous November. He announced the scrapping of the unpopular poll tax and pledged a new contract with the people.
What we now aim to do is to put in place a comprehensive citizens' charter.
In 1991, we experienced the first Gulf War. The economy was in recession for much of the year. Everyone knew an election was in the offing. And as the year progressed, the Labour leader, Neil Kinnock, was increasingly confident of success.
More years of Toryism would mean years more of falling behind our neighbours and competitors in Europe.
That year's census no longer asked people if they had an outside toilet. Instead, the question was about central heating. And Tim Berners-Lee introduced us to the World Wide Web for the first time that year. To understand better how factors like age, class, education, race, and social attitudes have altered the political landscape in the last 30 years, I turned to James Kanagasorium, the CEO of Stack Data Strategy, a polling company. We began talking about age.
Age back in the early 90s was a predicator of how people might vote, but it was quite loose, it was quite weak. The thing that really demarcated how you might vote for, whether that was on the right for the Conservatives in the UK or on the left for the Labour Party, was predominantly about class. It was predominantly about money. It was how rich you were or how poor you were.
So how has that changed in 2021?
Back in 1992, the Labour kind of conservative gap amongst young people was single digits. It was quite small. Lots of younger people voted conservative. Many, many old people voted for the Labour Party. The situation today is the age curve has steepened drastically over that time. The UK conservatives probably have somewhere between 40 to 50 points amongst people who are 65 plus, whereas amongst voters who are 18 to 24, so really young people, basically either straight out of university or in technical education or just working, the gap, it could be as much as 50 points between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. The main political realignment and rotation that has occurred between 1991, where we kind of begin our story, and today, is that the UK Conservatives used to do very well amongst older voters, but typically those with university education and those who were quite rich as well. But they did very poorly amongst more working class older voters. The net effect, basically, of picking up lots of working class older voters and to add them to your tally already of richer older voters means in aggregate that basically your vote is just old.
In other words, for the Conservatives, attracting older voters has been critical to their electoral success. So what about the changing face of class?
Back in the early 90s, very few people went to university and were educated. And so what we're really talking about when we mean class is culture and income, if that makes sense. We're really just talking about how much money you have and your resources, as well as some layer of cultural identifiers and identification. The situation today has become a lot more complicated. And the reason for that is that the markers of how well educated you are have become decoupled from your income. Whereas before, 20, 30 years ago, the degree to which an area or a group of people or a family were educated would strongly drive their income levels. Today, we have areas in the country that are very highly educated but are not that rich. But we also have other areas which are very rich but have low levels of university graduates. So the decoupling of it is why class is quite a complex question now, because actually it's not clear who are the working class, who are the upper class. I mean, the thing that really struck me looking into the statistics was that the percentage of people that called themselves working class has, according to the British Social Attitude Survey, has drastically increased across time, even as income levels have increased and university education has expanded from 8% to 29% of people. In 1992, 34% of Brits identified as middle class and 59% identified as working class. Today, in 2019, 26% of Brits identified as middle class and 70% identified as working class. All the while, there's been a massive material growth, massive increase in terms of people who are university educated. So something's going on here, which is there's been a total decoupling between self-perception and reality, but also education levels and income have also become decoupled.
And so what about race or the changing ethnic makeup of the UK? How significant has that been?
It's interesting to disaggregate the question of how much the country's changed versus how significant that is. So in 1991, 92% of the UK was white and British. That figure today, we approximate it at 84%. On a political level, I don't think the effect in terms of how constituencies might vote and the political weather, I don't think it has shifted the dial all that much, because BAME voters in the early 90s were very disproportionately Labour voters. The situation is exactly the same today. Estimates range the Labour vote anywhere between 60 to the kind of mid-70s in terms of the percentage of BAME voters, so those who are black or Asian or ethnic minority, who vote for the Labour Party. And because of that, there hasn't been a political shock. There's just been a steady increase. And in some areas, particularly in inner cities, has been quite a big increase in the ethnic makeup of those areas. That has changed how they might vote. But actually, across the whole of the country, it's been fairly limited in terms of its political impact.
However, James does point out that race has had a significant social impact, which brings us neatly onto other changing social attitudes.
Social attitudes, as opposed to economic ones, have almost all shifted to the left. And we can talk and we can unpack.
What kind of things are
we
talking about?
So if we take the case for equal marriage, that basically was very much a minority support back in the early 90s, would not have been entertained as a political objective. And basically up until the passing of the law on the Equal Marriage Act that happened under the Conservative Liberal Coalition, what was really interesting is that after it passed, that's actually when support exploded for the policy. And it's now broadly 2/3 to 3/4 of people support it and back it as a policy. Climate change is another one. That basically bobbed along, but it wasn't salient. You know, climate change back in the early 2000s, so let alone the early 90s, was out of the basket of things that really drove how people vote. And that's been transformational and it's been very sudden. Whereas there are other social attitudes that have shifted to the left slowly but inexorably. Let's take gender roles, for example. In 1991, I think 33% of people agreed with the objectively sexist view that a man's job is to earn money and a woman's job is to look after the home and family, only 44% of people disagreed. And if you look at the percentage today, 72% of people disagree with that statement. I mean, that's an absolute revolution. So I think the picture in terms of social attitude survey, you know, the type of country we are is very different. On some level, it's hugely more socially liberal. But on a number of other issues and other dimensions, it's pretty different. Economic attitudes have shifted significantly to the right. This is why our politics is complicated, because nothing has been linear. Things have changed in different directions depending on what basket of things you're looking at.
James Kanagasuriam laying a foundation for our discussion. To build on it, joining me in the briefing room now are Rob Ford, Professor of Political Science at Manchester University, Rosie Campbell, Professor of Politics from King's College London, and Paula Surridge, who is a political sociologist from the University of Bristol. Can we first talk about how age is working as a political factor in the UK? Paula, what did you think as you listened to what James said?
So I think there's two elements to age that we need to think a little bit more about. The first is that we've got this overlap between the age trends and education trends, and they're really hard to unpick. If you look at age on its own, without taking into account education, part of what you're picking up in age differences is the expansion of higher education. So part of the difference between the younger and the older age cohorts is the fact that the youngest age cohort is much more likely to have gone through higher education. And we also know that those that go through higher education tend to end up with a more liberal set of values. I don't think it explains all of it, but it certainly explains some of it. And I think that's a really important thing to bear in mind. I think the other thing that's really important to think about with age is the impact of non-voting, particularly young voters who don't go into higher education are really unlikely to turn out to vote. So in some senses, when we read the values and attitudes and opinions of young voters through their political behaviour, we're not getting a full picture because we're not understanding the values and attitudes of those young people, 50%, who don't go into higher education. They're less likely to respond to pollsters, to surveys, and we're less likely to have measures of their political behaviour.
Rob Ford, how do you see this feeding into social and political attitudes?
One thing which I think Paula also flagged up is the electorate is changing because the share of people belonging to the graduate class has grown very rapidly. Also amongst younger cohorts, you see a lot more people from ethnic minority backgrounds. These people have always thought differently. The highly educated have always been more cosmopolitan. Ethnic minority voters have always had distinctive attitudes too. But because there's more of them in the electorate, they speak louder. Conversely, because younger socially conservative voters have dropped out of the electorate, they speak with a less loud voice. As Lyndon Johnson observed long ago, the first rule of politics is being able to count. And the bigger the group is, the louder its voice will be within the political conversation. So that long-term shift towards more graduates and more ethnically diverse electorate necessarily changes our political conversation because the numbers game changes. The second thing that we do see is a general change in what one might describe as the zeitgeist of particular generations. Because younger generations in Britain have grown up in an environment that is more open, more ethnically diverse, more socially liberal on many dimensions, they kind of imbibe that spirit. And you can see that across their sort of educational background, their class backgrounds, people from younger cohorts tend to have more liberal attitudes. So it's two things, really. The balance of groups in the electorate is changing, and also the balance of attitudes within particular generations is different as well.
Rosie Campbell, that seems like a very good point to examine this other thing that James looked at, which was the decoupling between education levels and economic status. What also gets linked to class. 70% of us regard ourselves as working class, though, of course, more of us have higher education than ever before.
When we think about the decoupling of education and economic status, it really raises some questions in my mind. working class is a political concept, and it used to be really associated with trade union activism, working men's clubs, local communities that would think of themselves as a working class community. And actually, as we've moved into a post-industrial period, we know that a lot of those institutions have shrunken in size in terms of their connection to people. And so I think we don't really know what working class means anymore. If you ask me, am I working class? Well, I'll probably think, well, my mum and dad weren't posh. They're not aristocrats. We weren't loaded with money. Yes, I'm working class. You know, I don't know if we mean the same thing.
Is the same thing true, Rob, of middle classes? I mean, is it true that there was a kind of identification through rotary clubs or golf clubs or things like that, which would create a kind of class solidarity in both areas?
No, and this is where I think there's one of the interesting changes in recent decades. If you go back to the kind of classic studies on electoral choice back in the 60s and 70s, the kind of classic class politics era, what the researchers of that time noticed was an asymmetry. So working class voters voted their class identity. If you asked, why are you voting Labour? They'd say, because I'm working class and Labour is the party of the working class. Middle class voters didn't behave like that. They didn't regard their middle class identity as particularly important to them, and they didn't give it spontaneously as a reason for voting for the Conservatives. They regarded the Conservatives as a classless party. They regarded their class as not a visible aspect of their personality. Now, of course, one can say that there's a lot of self-deception involved in that and so on, and that actually they were middle class, even if they didn't see that as important to their motivations. But nonetheless, that's how they viewed it. These days, with the rise of a kind of graduate politics, I think you are seeing the emergence of a stronger, self-conscious political identity in parts of the middle class. We see that particularly strongly, of course, with Brexit, where we see what is primarily a socially liberal graduate population defining itself as Remain and orientating itself politically around that identity. And I really think that is a difference from the classic era of class politics, because before it was a working class party for working class voters who saw themselves that way versus a party that defined itself as classless and sought to downplay the elements of class. Now both sides are seeing this division in terms of a group identification.
Okay, I want to move on now to some of the other changes which we've talked about. Rosie Campbell, is there now a change in the way in which gender might affect outlook and voting behaviour? I mean, I seem to recall that when I was a teenager, more women regularly voted for the Conservative Party than men, whatever it was that arose from. What's the pattern we see now?
Oh, you've really got me on my hobby horse. I'm so glad you asked. I wrote a PhD about gender and voting behaviour in the early 2000s, and the story was basically exactly as you said. Women were more likely to vote Conservative during the post-war period. And there's a sort of well-trod phrase that's always brought out that actually would have had continuous Conservative government if only women had voted. But actually, in the last two elections, for the first time, we've actually seen a greater proportion of women voting Labour than men. So we've got what's termed a modern gender gap, more women voting to the left of men. I think what the underlying explanation is, we've been talking about the age effect, the generational divides. And what we haven't sort of discussed is that that is massively gendered. We know women have accessed higher education in greater numbers and paid employment. Women's lives are very different. Younger women today expect to work throughout their lifetime compared to older women who perhaps didn't work or had long periods without work. And that means their material interests as well as their values, because religion was always more important for women than men, and we're less religious. So this generational divide we're describing actually has a significant gender dimension to it. And younger women are a lot more likely to be on the left than younger men.
Now, let's talk about ethnicity, Paula. How is changing ethnicity impacting on political outlook? And I suppose one of the things that we ought to beware, shouldn't we, is the notion that different ethnicity automatically means something in political terms, because there are many different ethnicities.
The real difficulty in this area is that we don't know nearly enough, because when we look at the kinds of data that we use to analyse age patterns or education patterns or gender patterns, it's very, very difficult to disaggregate patterns by ethnicity.
there's one thing we do know about ethnicity, which is that Lord Ashcroft's observation from the early 2000s, which is that if you wanted to ask one question to figure out if someone voted Conservative or Labour, you'd ask them their ethnic group. That still holds today, perhaps it holds even more strongly today than it used to. Every single ethnic minority group, if you take ethnic minority voters and white voters of similar age, class, income, and so forth, the ethnic minority voters of every single group will be more Labour than the white voters. There's a lot of variation between different ethnic minority groups, that's true, but every single one is more Labour-leaning than equivalent white voters. The second observation I'd make is there's a really big division within the white population in terms of how they think about their identity. White voters in England who think of themselves as English, not British, behave very differently now politically than white voters who think of themselves as British, not English. Similarly, white voters in Scotland who think of themselves as Scottish, not British, or British, not Scottish, are poles apart politically, and far more so than back in 1991.
Let's talk about how these characteristics and others impact on different parts of Britain. Paula, I want to start with Wales.
Yes, so Wales is a really interesting case politically, and I think that was borne out by the recent devolved elections, as it was a place where Labour did quite well in contrast to other parts of the country. It's a place that voted Leave. Some of the constituencies and parts of Wales share much in common with some of the industrial north that we've seen move quite dramatically over the last 10 years. But Wales has got this different national identity layered on the top, and that plays out politically quite differently. So to say that you feel British in Wales is a political statement that's different from saying you feel British in England, and it plays out quite differently. We know that most recently over the COVID period, that kind of sense of difference in Wales has been growing, and that Welsh identity has become even more important because this has really brought home that Wales can do things differently. So Welsh identity is a really important part, but it doesn't work politically in the same way that English identity does. But it also doesn't quite work in the same way as Scottish identity. So it's quite unique in that sense.
Rob Ford, those of us of a certain age who can remember when the Conservatives actually held a large, almost a majority of the seats in Scotland, can be amazed by how things have changed. What are we to make of how permanent those changes are?
Well, I mean, Scotland is a really powerful illustration of how a conflict that is about both identity and constitutional status can completely realign a whole political system. So the current primary dividing line in Scottish politics is almost entirely around the question of whether or not Scotland should be an independent nation. You ask people that question and they'll have a very good idea whether they're SNP or not SNP, which splits the country roughly 50-50. And then if you ask people whether they think of themselves as Scottish or British, that also provides a really powerful predictor of how people line up politically. And what's interesting is, as you mentioned, the Conservatives were once a nationwide party in Scotland as well. They have resurged in recent years, but they've resurged by building support in a very different part of the electorate because they've been able to mobilise along this alignment. The Scottish Labour Party, once dominant, is not seen by Scottish voters as having a clear position on either the question of independence or the question of Brexit, where, of course, Scotland also behaved quite differently to the rest of the UK. Whereas both the SNP, who are yes to independence, no to Brexit, and the Scottish Conservatives, who are no to independence, yes to Brexit, are seen as having very clear positions on those two arguments.
How do the other things that we were discussing play out in Scotland, though, Rob, the questions of age and education?
This gets very interesting and is an illustration, incidentally, of how politicians are not a passenger in this process of social and demographic change. They influence and shape the meaning of that change politically. So in Scotland, you have the same trends, rising education levels, growing divisions by education, as you have in England, rising ethnic diversity too. But in Scotland, Scottish politics that has been framed around a very different sense of us against them. In English politics, us against them is very often a question of England versus Europe, where you stand on immigration, where you stand on ethnic diversity. In Scotland, us against them is about where you stand on Holyrood versus Westminster. The out-group that mobilises voters in Scotland is very often England or Westminster or the Conservative Party, and those things are often sort of drawn in an overlapping way by the Scottish National Party. And that has enabled the SNP to kind of bridge both sides of the educational divide, because for lower education white voters who are often quite tribal, there's a tribal narrative of we're standing up for Scotland against the English. But for the highly educated voters who are more cosmopolitan, there is a narrative of we are standing up for a cosmopolitan Scotland and cosmopolitan values against the intolerant English. So by emphasising different aspects of the narrative, you can appeal to both sides of the divide, whereas in England you don't see many arguments current in English politics that bridge that divide. Instead, the arguments tend to drive a wedge between those groups and polarise that divide.
Rosie Campbell, the commentator Daniel Finkelstein, writing in The Times this week, said, actually, forget the culture wars, it's still the economy, stupid, effectively. What do you think of that argument?
I think it's a really profound and important argument. If you look at the UK today, you know, a lot of these culture wars, as they've been described, are, I think, being inflated. We know that there has been significant division around immigration, and that has become more important over time, especially after recent waves of immigration from Eastern Europe. But actually, on many of the other dimensions, I think they're much less politically contested among voters than some of the newspapers and some of our commentators would like. You know, we've talked about attitudes to women's rights. You know, that is not a huge divider of the electorate. And I think actually, this kind of wedging the electorate into these ideological divisions is a strategic move, because actually trying to fix these long-term economic and geographical problems is a massive uphill task. And actually, if you could just segment the electorate into divisions that you can mobilise to support you at election time, that might be a little bit easier.
That seems a really good point to look at what the implication is of all this for our major political parties, because what you've all talked about is a far greater fragmentation, a much looser party affiliation, a much greater fluidity. So if I'm a leader of a political party, what am I to make of it, Rob Ford?
I think it's a much harder job now than perhaps it was in 1991 to construct a stable political coalition. You've got less party identity to rely on as a resource, as a kind of glue to hold your coalition together. And there's a lot more internal contradictions amongst the kind of voters that you have. I mean, in terms of the Danny Finkelstein quote, I think the thing that he neglects there is he tries to make this either or. It has to either be a matter of economic interest or a matter of identity. But voters don't think like that. It's both and for them in politics. High-income voters are more conservative than low-income voters. But if they're high-income Remainers or high-income social liberals, they're more conflicted and they're increasingly more likely to shift to other parties, as we saw in Chesham and Amersham. Conversely, if you're a low-income voter, you gravitate to Labour. But if you're a low-income Leaver or a low-income English, not British identifier or a low-income immigration sceptic, then you're conflicted again. And the problem for parties in our system is that our electoral system is built around the idea of building really broad coalitions. And that always is going to involve some degree of internal tension. And as our society becomes more diverse, and that diversity matters more for voters in terms of how they make their choices, building a broad coalition that's stable becomes much more difficult.
Paul, is that how you see it?
It's very much in line with how I see it. I talk a lot about this process of fragmentation, and I guess in my head, I see it almost like a mosaic, that you can put those different fragments together to make kind of different pictures, different pathways, if you like, to power. But it's going to take a certain amount of skill to do that. You can't rely on those kind of instinctive identities that were already beginning to break down in 91. But previously to that, people did have this kind of attachment to parties. And I think the weakening of that attachment to parties at the same time as the increased salience of some of the issues on the kind of liberal side cross-cutting the economics means that we've fragmented into some quite distinctive groupings within the electorate, none of which on their own are large enough for a party to win an election on. And somehow you've got to find the ways of stitching those together to make that group that's big enough to win you an election.
Paula Surridge there with Rob Ford and Rosie Campbell. And all I can add is that I rather like mosaics. My thanks to them and to James Kanagasuriam. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Ronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirstine Knight and Ben Carter. The sound was mixed by Graham Puddifoot and the editor is Jasper Corbett. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've looked into what's going on between Ukraine and Russia. We've explored the challenges the Taliban have been facing in forming a government. We've investigated the world of viral variants and how dangerous a new COVID variant might be. And we've asked why our rivers are still so polluted.
From the makers of the Battersea Poltergeist, a new podcast series for BBC Radio 4. Uncanny.
Do you believe in ghosts?
No.
Have you seen one?
Yes.
Real life stories of the supernatural, told by the people they happen to. Presented by me, Danny Robbins.
There was a very strong sense of pure evil.
Subscribe to Uncanny on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.